episode is a bit unusual for Froddish. It is a true crime story. I don't do a lot of real true crime, but this story really caught me. Maybe because right now there is a $1.9 billion Powerball, and I don't gamble. And all because of a LinkedIn connection did I get to meet Terry Rich. Terry Rich caught the largest lottery theft so far, like they say in The Simpsons. So let's get going. A very special episode today because this goes into the sort of daisy chain of podcasts and people that we know in the speaking industry. I was introduced to Terry Rich via a gig that I'm hoping to get, and I saw his stuff and I was immediately fascinated. And so I reached out to him and he was gracious enough to come on Froddish this week. So thank you very much, Terry. We are going to start with a quick little speed round of word association. When you hear the word fraud, what do you think? Sure.
Embezzlement.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Ethics.
I think moral character comes to mind.
Okay. And what do you think of when you hear hot lotto?
8 years of my life at Ocean.
Okay. So, Terry, why don't you give the audience sort of where you're at and how you got there and how you're so famous in the lottery world?
Sure. I grew up on a farm, little small farm, Iowa town. And growing up on a farm, you learn a little about ethics, hard work, that sort of thing. But came out of college and got into television, cable television, before cable way, and marketing and promotion kind of became my brand. An idea dude, I've been called many times. And I hit one of those Google deals with a business where, when at age 40, all of a sudden they cashed us out. Cable television was going so strong and I had everything I wanted. And I realized that happiness happens on the way to success. But during that real entrepreneurial times, we had a president named Jim County who kept saying, you know, I did the programming, so I did deals with vendors. He said, I don't care what you do, Rich, but whatever you do, do a fair and honest deal because I want to sleep at night. And that put a little ethics in me that I carried all the way through. Worked for HBO and did a lot of on-camera work nationally. But then at age 50, midlife crisis, I decided to try to do something as a give back. And the next governor called and said, our city zoo, be interested in running a zoo. And I thought, well, grew up on a farm, I could run a zoo probably. So we turned it around, raised a whole bunch of money, got $15 million in endowment. So it'll be around forever and a really fun give back to the community. Another governor called and said, hey, would you be interested in running the lottery? You like marketing and promotions. And that's where I got into the fraud. A couple of years into it, we had a gentleman that bought a ticket, local convenience store, and we didn't hear from him for almost a year. And at that point, when we did hear, we heard from a lawyer, an ex-lawyer in Canada, who said, hey, I've got the ticket. And as we talk the fraud today, you're going to hear my stories, which says, number one, that it takes quite a while to actually find a fraud and to bust a fraud and convict a fraud. And number two, why checks and balances are so important for your organization. So anyway, he bought the ticket, took it down, and we didn't hear anything for almost a year until we got a call from a lawyer in Canada, an ex-lawyer in Canada, who said, hey, I've got the ticket. I'm going to send it to you. Just send me the $16.5 million. Yeah, right, buddy. We're going to do that. We need to do some checks and balances. So we did some checks. He got scared. He said that he bought it and he committed a fraud because he called back later and said, I told a little fib. So we got the Department of Criminal Investigations involved and all these other folks involved, and ultimately busted the largest lottery fraud in U.S. history.
That is amazing. And sort of Paul Harvey, the rest of the story, the guy, Eddie Tipton, just got out, even though he was paroled in January, but then he got in some type of altercation. And so then it got delayed, but he got out, I believe, in July or August of this summer. Has he given you a call?
No, he is not. I'm assuming I won't get a horse head in my bed. I think Eddie was like we all are. I learned from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners that people who commit fraud within an organization, there's a triangle, and all three things have to align before someone says, okay, I'm going to do this. First is financial need. Now, you and I both like to make money, but financial need, when you hire somebody, usually occurs. They might be great employees, but maybe they go through a divorce, gambling, drugs, drinking problems, and they get to the point where I just have to find a way to make more money. But they have to have the second and third angle of that triangle to really get by with it. The second is opportunity. The idea that if you know a local churches where the church secretary, Aunt Mabel, I can't believe that she stole from that, and we found out she was gambling, but she had all the keys of the kingdom. She wrote the purchase order. She wrote the checks, and she was able to combine and do that without anybody finding her until ultimately she got greedy and got too big. The third one is the toughest I found as a CEO to oversee, and that is rationale. At what point does a little devil, do you rationalize that little devil's right to say, you know, Sally over here makes more money than you do. You're working harder than anybody else. You deserve it. All of those three combined will combine to internal fraud. And it happened in this case, too. And I love telling the story. That's what I do for my retirement, is going out and telling the story, because it's some pretty easy steps you can take to prevent fraud within your organization.
So we know that Eddie Tipton's opportunity was his position as director of IT security. What was his pressure and his rationalization? Do you know?
I'll give you what my opinion is. You know, when that lawyer called, lied a little bit, didn't come in, he handed it to another lawyer who did come in, try to claim it. We said, no way. And ultimately found out through social media, if you ever commit fraud, don't use social media, don't use your cell phone. But through all of those, we figured out who they were all talking and the person who we knew had the ticket. Ultimately, that's how we got Eddie through social media and cell phone records in the past. So when we went through the trial and we found all of this out, we found that it was Eddie Tipton. As you mentioned, he was an IT security officer for the multi-state lottery, not our lottery, the Iowa lottery, but for multi-state lottery. But he was a security person over this game called Hot Lotto. 17 states he oversaw. And in those 17 states, we played Hot Lotto and Powerball and Mega Millions, but those were drawn with balls, not with a computer. You see, Eddie, when he first came, convinced the board to say, hey, we could do this a lot cheaper if I just did it on a computer and I got a random number generator to generate the numbers. But Eddie wrote the program. So you're starting to see that the checks and balances a little bit wasn't there, because he wrote the program, he oversaw the compilation of the program, and then he was the oversight of the boss themselves, the security officer for that organization. So he had all the keys to the kingdom. Now, as CEOs or as leaders in an organization, a lot of us have, sometimes the financial leader, have the opportunity by having all the keys to the kingdom. But what we found when we did the proffer, after Eddie was found guilty, and we said the one thing I wanted in the proffer was for him to say, did we get them all? Did we get all the jackpots he went after? And two, why did he do it? And the reasons were there. The rationale, his best friend just went through a major lawsuit, as I understand, and owed the government or the SEC $2 million. His brother was going through a divorce or thinking about divorce, and he needed a little extra money. And Eddie, after he got by with a couple of jackpots in other states, actually needed more money for this big house he was building. He just got greedy. And with that, he knew that when he was sitting there working on all of the security stuff within the small organization, he kept saying, they called me every night. I'd go on vacation. I would get called on my cell phone, and they didn't have the checks and balances in place for that. So all of that rationalized to him. He's overworked. He's trying, you know, all the hard things that are there. And he really didn't have that oversight that would have controlled those checks and balances.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked at some pictures of him, and I think he uses some vices to head cope with his life. I'm going to go with that he used some vices to cope with his life. So,
Well, his brother, Tommy was there. You know, the interesting part about Eddie, when you saw that picture, you realize he's a rather large gentleman. He's very smart, I think, in his own way. But being large kind of tripped him up, because when you have an investigation going, little things you never expect often trip up criminals. He didn't realize that was the first time he bought it himself rather than give it to friends to buy, so that nobody became suspicious when you tried to claim it. So that tripped him up. The second was hot dogs. And the reason that tripped him up, so when he went to trial first on just in Iowa on a couple of charges, and they wanted a character witness. So they asked his brother, who was part of the scheme, to come up and testify. Now, how dumb is that? He gets on stand, has to testify. And his brother said, you know, that wasn't my brother on that videotape in that convenience store. He don't like hot dogs. He was buying hot dogs. And you know what? An Associated Press reporter and looked over at Eddie, a 300-400-pound guy, and thought, this guy didn't like hot dogs. And the AP reporter thought it was so unique, he wrote a national article, which went back down to his brother Tommy, who was saying how nice a guy he was as a brother, to his hometown. And an FBI agent said, wait a minute, that Tommy Tipton, we interviewed him in the hospital because he had fallen out of a tree. He fell out of a tree, and when they were interviewing him, he said, well, no, I wasn't money laundering, because they thought he was money laundering, and they were investigating him on. This was 10 years before all of this happened. They were investigating for money laundering, and he said, no, I won the Colorado lottery. Immediately, that FBI agent called up to our agents. Again, we went back to cell phone records and social media, got all of their contacts together, and then cross-referenced that with all of the winners in the United States of $600 or more, and immediately found five jackpots that these guys had either rigged and received money, and the only one they'd hadn't received money was the one that we busted.
Wow. So this goes to, do you know what an aptonym is? Okay, well, nope. You're an aptonym. So your name, Terry Rich, you are an aptonym. So there is a woman who just got a sentence of 8 years. She was a CEO of a foreign-owned corporation in North Carolina, and she's a serial embezzler. And guess what her last name is?
What's that?
Steele.
Yeah, my name was Rich. Take it even further. They had a couple of friends that they had claim the very last jackpot, another hot lotto jackpot, and their last name was the Conn Brothers. Who knew? So you can't make some of this stuff up. But when there is fraud, you realize that there are some simple techniques that we could have had, or that organization could have had. And what I found is one of the simplest is just having a policy that when you're hired, to say that if you get caught, you will be prosecuted. The gentleman, Rob Sand, who prosecuted this, tells a story that you'll save 50% of your fraud cases internally if you basically have a policy which says if you're caught, you will be prosecuted. And the other is, he said that criminals often they worry more about that they will actually be charged, you know, rather than just being let go on probation or whatever. Back to that rationale is a pretty crazy case. And there was another case that he talked about, which really demonstrates that. Imagine small counties in your state, and they had a business manager, and that business manager decided that they were so small that let's have another county and we can just have one person overseeing both counties. But in the county she was in, she had this old crusty guy, probably looked like me, old and crusty and just complained about things, never looked at the minutes or the agenda, but was always the one to sit back and look at her and say, now you ain't stealing nothing, are you? You know what? She stole over $200,000 or hundreds of thousands, as I understand it. But you know what? She didn't steal it from the county where the guy asked that question. She stole it from the other county where no one ever asked the question. Oversight is so important in these. And you know what? Most oversight, you think of external auditors only catch about 4%, according to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, only 4% of internal fraud. You know where the most is? Employees, vendors, and anonymous tip. So if you have a company, small or big, you really should have a way. You tell people, hey, if you think something's happening, contact the HR department or our legal department. And that you'll save internal fraud by almost 50%.
Yeah. It's amazing how many, my biggest cases have come from tips, and, but how many organizations, they don't think that they need a hotline, or the hotlines are too expensive. And there are some hotlines that are very expensive, but I know of hotlines that are very, very reasonable. Then the other thing is they're kind of like, oh, then we're going to have to hire someone to actually investigate it. And, you know, you're going to get someone who complains that the tuna sandwich was stolen every Monday. And so it's kind of that fear of, I want to say, the known unknown. They know it's happening, but they're like, it's just never going to be material.
Absolutely. And, you know, the majority of people who commit fraud have never committed it before. I think only like 65% of the people who have committed fraud either get charged or the police are called in. You know what happens to the other 35%? They are empowered to go to the next place and steal again. Eddie got caught by those tips because we were almost to the very end. We only had 2 months, 3 months left in our statute of limitations to find Eddie, charge Eddie, find out who did it, because we didn't know for almost 2.5, 3 years we were doing all this investigation. So they decided to release the tape. Now, if you're going to steal from somewhere, never do it in a convenience store, because today's convenience store have all sorts of audio. And this one had a video even back in that day. So video and audio. And then when you get the ticket, if you check it, you're back on another video and audio if it's another store. But we didn't release that tape because we were worried that, you know, the convenience store owned the tape. And what if somebody came in and wasn't with their wife, they're with a girlfriend, vice versa, whatever. So the prosecutor with 3 months left said, let's release the tape, you know, and then we did an anonymous tip line. And that's where we found it. I mean, we had thoughts of what might be, but when we released that anonymous tip line that really did the trick, and people called and said, hey, that's Eddie Tipton. Well, Eddie Tipton, he was in charge of security of that game. And that's the start of the story.
And you can't make this stuff up. I mean, you know, when I do my presentations and some people hear my stories, they think that I am, like, you know, exaggerating, and I don't have to exaggerate to make this stuff up at all.
Not at all.
And we only catch the dumb ones, the low hanging fruit. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. We waited a whole year, because most people can't really mentally wait a whole year. But when it was that much money.
And I think he realized after he bought it and after we started barking of, hey, that he bought it in the wrong state, because 11 or 12 states allow you to claim anonymously. If he'd have bought this in Kansas, claimed it in Kansas, but because he bought it in Iowa and our law says we need to know who it was, I think he bought it. You can be criticized for doing too much press. I did a lot of press because that was my background. We kept going after it, that he probably then, one of his lawyers figured out that, hey, you may have to go in and claim this. And so they passed it from a lawyer in Houston, Texas, to his friend, to his lawyer, to a lawyer in New York, to a lawyer in Canada. And with 2 or 3 weeks left before that ticket was to expire, to call and say, hey, I'm just going to send you the ticket. You send me the money. We're saying, yeah, buddy. And it kind of goes back to culture, because the first person that lawyer in Canada called was a frontline employee, and she knew it didn't feel right. You see something, say something. She called up to security and to her public relations. You guys better talk to this. When they did, he then said, I bought it, and created the fraud, which started the whole array of dominoes. The other thing that I thought was interesting in this, and I tell the story because I never, ever want to be asked this question by investigators, is when they finally figured out the code and we figured out how he did it, and we had the smoking gun, all three of them confessed. And how that happened was they go to all three. In fact, when they went to the lawyer in New York and the lawyer in Canada, here's the question you ask that I never want to be asked. Do you want to be the defendant or do you want to be the witness? And it was amazing how fast people say, I'll be the witness. They don't want to be thrown in jail, right? So when all is said and done, you know, the management thing, topics that I talk about, is one of them is to kind of have peace with it, is to say, I believe in the judicial system, and when it happens, it's great. And we got something very few people that are involved in a fraud case have, and that's closure. When you see that they all three confessed and they all three were sentenced with restitution, most people don't get that because it's appealed. If it's a murder or an assault, those are appealed all the way to Supreme Court and take years and years. And you always feel like, geez, did this really happen? They can make you feel like you're stupid that it didn't work.
Okay. So did the two lawyers confess? Did they get
the two lawyers? Yeah. When Eddie takes the ticket, he drives it to Houston, Texas, gives this to his friend, Robert Rhodes. When he did that, he then sent it to New York to a lawyer. When our investigators talked to those two, they asked them that question, and they both said, we'll tell you where it came from. It came from Houston, Texas. And so for that, they weren't charged.
Darn it all. That means we have a couple of lawyers out there who should have been disbarred. And I mean,
There are probably even more than that. There's even stranger stories of other lawyers in this deal, one of which may have the numbers that Eddie gave to his brother Tommy to win the Colorado lottery. He saw it, told him, hey, come back tomorrow and I'll tell you whether I think you, if you're your brother, that we can do this. And we think that he won, Tommy won, and then somebody else won in Colorado. So instead of the entire jackpot, they only did part of it. So, you know, Eddie supposedly programmed up to 50 computers that he sent around because he was in charge of security for games. And so people would be buying his computers with this code on, and almost 50 of them went out across the United States. So all of those have been replaced. Checks and balances have come in. And, you know, that's the important point. If you think about, are balls better than numbers? Letting a computer draw your number? No, because Pennsylvania, you know, anytime Pennsylvania had a big case in 1985, they made a movie out of, where somebody put latex paint inside the ping pong balls so that only certain balls bounce, and they bought that combination. But bottom line is, whether you're in a church, whether you're in a bank, whether you're, no matter where you're at, if there's money involved, you need the checks and balances.
Yeah. And I like to say surprise and delight. Keep your employees on their toes. If you only look at checks over $5,000, pull one for 500. If the auditors come in June, make them come in November 1 year instead. So these are things that, like, tons of artificial intelligence or McKinsey Corp or Boston Consulting Group is going to implement. It's really pretty simple stuff, but it's implementing. So you mentioned something earlier that you couldn't do it anonymous in Iowa, but in other states, you could do it anonymous. When this broke, did those other states change their rules so it couldn't be anonymous? Because you would think that's a no-brainer.
Well, it went exactly the opposite. We changed the Powerball from $1 to $2, and all of a sudden we got billion-dollar jackpots here and there. And when the billion-dollar jackpots came up, many people and legislators started thinking, well, we don't want somebody attacked in China. Everybody can claim anonymously. They wear masks because people get killed if somebody wins a big one. But we've never had a major assault or killing. So, but at the $1.5 billion, the rumors started going around, why should we be releasing these people's names? My God, you know, so they could be shot, they'd be killed, the kids are going to be kidnapped. And so a few states implemented it back in. I've been a huge proponent of openness because in our state, people can sell a farm and have $10 to $50 million. And what's the difference between, that's always public, what's the difference between that and winning the lottery? So, yeah, there is. And if Eddie, you know, he was pretty smart, but if he had just been smart enough to buy those in other states, unfortunately, he'd still be doing it.
Yeah. Well,
let me mention one more thing.
Yeah.
What happens is Eddie started on smaller jackpots in state games where it was only in one particular state that he could send people in to get them. He got greedy. He saw this hot lotto jackpot reach one of the top ever been, and he only had one day. The way he programmed it, there was only one day a year that he could buy tickets, and he had to buy 200 combinations to make it work. Why did he do that? Because he had to make it complicated so it couldn't easily be traced if somebody wanted to check the code. And so he just got greedy, no doubt about it. He went after the big one, and that's what busted him.
Yeah, that's, I mean, sometimes the greed gets to be too much. Sometimes someone makes just a stupid error because they get cocky or lazy or just, you know, So you said something also earlier about, I think it was telling a little fib. And how telling a little fib can just, and I just was listening to another podcast this morning about lying and cheating. And, you know, basically everyone cheats. At some point, everyone.
Yeah, think about it. Where does it become? Remember that rationale we talked about? Where does it come, the point where you're saying, nah, better not do it? I mean, everybody goes to work every day, and maybe you're a little low on copy paper at home or a pencil or a stapler. They're not going to miss it. There's the rationale. Well, get by with that. Then, well, you know, maybe why don't I just take the whole printer out, because then I'll be doing more stuff at home. You know, at what point does it stop? And so if you start it, often people get by with a little bit by the church secretary taking a couple dollars out of the offering plate, and then it just gets bigger at the time they do that. So there's no easy answer to that except good oversight.
Well, so now Powerball lottery this week is like already at 1.9 billion. So I have a feeling people will be calling you. I don't gamble. Like, gambling is a pink flag. And I had a family member who had an issue with it. It is my line in the sand, even yep. though I'm like going, oh, 1.9 billion, the money's going to go to a school or a park or something like that. But like, I just think for me personally, I don't want to cross that line.
You're a typical player in your thoughts and actions. Gets big. Why not try that? And I think the key is any gambling, you got to play with your head, not above your head. You want to, if you're gambling, take your pop money and spend it and be done and know it's call it and it's entertainment, but don't reach back in your pocket if you don't win and do it again. And you're right. The rationale is pretty crazy. As the lottery director, I could have doubled what I was selling, but you really have to be careful not to over promote and over promise. And people's knack and wanting to win, people want to gamble. And that's why I think it's good that it's set up the way it is by states running the lotteries, because you know where to talk to the governor or somebody else if you think something's amiss. And that checks and balance is probably a big thing that I think makes it fair. And then people say, well, you know, I didn't win, so it went to education or whatever, just like you did there. I guarantee you when they buy the ticket, they're thinking, I'm keeping the whole darn thing when I get it, you know. But when they lose, it's an easy answer to their wife or their daughter back to problem gambling to say, oh, well, it went to a good cause, so I do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this weekend, and there was a guy in China who apparently won $30 million and didn't tell his wife and kid. Because he said, this is in the news story, apparently, he wanted his wife and child to learn what hard work was.
Yeah. I bet he would be divorced and off in America by then. Tommy Tipton had the same deal. I mean, he had the first one. He gave the money to a friend, Alexander Hick. Remember, we talked a little about why he was in the hospital bed. Well, he was a Bigfoot hunter and he fell out of a tree stand hunting Bigfoot. It's the reason he was in there. And his Bigfoot hunting friend got the first ticket from Eddie to buy in Colorado to win. And when he did that, his friend gave Tommy the money in cash for the same reason you're talking. He didn't want his wife to know about it. It's my understanding. And so he got 90% of it in cash, but they were in marked bills, sequential bills. So he worried about, somebody's going to say something. So he went to a fireworks dealer, exchanged them for some other $100 bills. And the fireworks dealer got nervous and called the FBI. And that's how that all came back around when it was all said and done.
So no one ever turned in Eddie Tipton, like, or pressured him to, like, okay, I did this once for you. I want to do it again.
Yeah, the three together work pretty closely together over the time, but they never really came out. When we started investigating, once they heard that we'd opened a case, which took almost 3 years before we actually went in and took Eddie out of the facility, he and his friend did another one 8 months later because they needed the money in Oklahoma and got the money, won it the following November. So if you have more than one person, it's pretty tough to keep a secret.
Right. So this just came into my head, but so when the person bought the ticket, they obviously like paid taxes on it. And then they had to give a percentage to Eddie.
That's right. That's right. And once you get in the higher tax bracket, you pay the taxes, get the cash, and then do it. It's just like money laundering. You know, a lot of people take money, and if they're taking it in, they don't mind paying the taxes because it was free money to begin with if they're doing money laundering illegally. In this case, they often would pay it and then, pay it out either in cash or, you know, have the bills paid. A lot of people aren't smart enough to realize they're paying it out. So when they would give it back to Tommy or Eddie, then they all of a sudden got hit with the tax bill and kind of wonder, wait a minute here, what's going on? So it's, you know, those are important things to remember.
And I take it none of them took it as like this annuity type payment.
No. And that, you know, it's an interesting point because today with as big jackpots roll today, politically you hear the word inflation. Inflation has hit even the lottery business because in the old days, if you won $1 million, you'd get about 600,000 right out of the chute because the first step is the federal government takes 25% and the local governments take up to 5, 6, 7%. So that they get some of the money in case you skip town, then you have to claim everything and you've already paid some. So you may pay more, you may pay less depending on your tax bracket. But the annuity is a different deal because the actual cash is always the same. interest rates have gone up. So seeing the $1.9 billion jackpot probably 4 years ago would be $1.3 billion because you're doing it over 20, 30 years at 3-4% versus 0.5-1% in the old days of that annuity. So I get a kick out of that as I see that jackpot really rolling today as one of the retired lottery directors.
Okay, so I have to ask you, have you bought a Powerball ticket for the $1.9 billion?
So I am now retired, and I've been retired a couple of years. I've been playing this last year. I've won $4. I probably spent $60, $70. But that's the way the lotteries work. It's pretty much a 25% margin, the way that scratch tickets and these games are designed and set up. I think I would probably have an investigation if I won, knowing it's one in 300 million. I'm a realist. I know I probably won't. But I get a kick out of people asking me, are you playing? Are you playing? And I say, yeah. And I think it's fair and honest. And if I win, I'm going to go claim it because I'm not touching anything before I buy that. I don't buy numbers, which Eddie bought. He knew what numbers to buy. I play the quick pick as you go in and let the computer pick it. Then that's a random number there. And I know it's a random number on the backside that's being drawn with the ball. So yeah, do you think you'd be talking to me again if I won? I don't know.
So my dad used to buy a couple tickets a week and, he'd go, I want to stop at this place. You know, we'd be out doing something together. And I'm like, Here, Dad, you give me $10 and I'll give you back $5 and you'll feel good about it.
And I will one more.
And he's you just like, it. He's yeah, like, that's... you just take the fun out of everything. And I'm like, that's actually
yeah, the dreaming is what Powerball is all about. Yeah. Dreaming is what Powerball is all about versus the scratch tickets are more like a slot machine to me because that's a guaranteed payout. 100 tickets will pay out about 65% of the money, guaranteed. That's the way they're designed. They don't have a jackpot or the odds are a whole different deal. So, yeah, it's fun to dream and think what if, as long as you're knowing that if you lose, you said, well, that was fun entertainment and fun to dream. And if you win, then you're really happy, but the majority of people won't. But gambling is going to happen. And I'd rather have the states running the lotteries than I would having organized crime running the lotteries.
Yeah. I remember a long, long time ago, my husband and I, when the whatever lottery would get big, we'd go and we'd buy a $2 ticket. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go out to dinner that night and we'd talk about what we would do. And it was like entertainment. It was like cheaper than a movie.
That's right.
But then I told you I had a family member who had an issue. And then I said, no, I can't.
Smart.
I can't support it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And the beauty of it is it should be your choice. I mean, I hate to have the government tell me what I'm spending. I hate to have the government tell, you know, when we paid out prizes, I would give them the advice of getting a tax attorney, get a lawyer. The other thing I always ask winners to call back and tell us things. The number one thing they always said that they wish they had done or they knew when they got the big jackpot is I wish they had waited 30 or 60 days before they made the first big purchase because they might have wanted a yellow Maserati versus a green Maserati, you know? So I always told them that. You still have the money in 30 days.
Yeah, they can buy all different rainbow of Maseratis this week if they win the $1.9 billion.
That's right.
Dollar one. They can have every color.
So here's another question that always comes up. Here's another question comes up in these deals. Why can't somebody just buy all the combinations? Well, if you realize there are 300 million combinations, it would cost you $600 million. So at some point, it wouldn't be worth the return. You're going to pay taxes on it. The other is you can't print tickets fast enough to get 300 million tickets. So you'd have to have a lot of people buying all over the place and you'd have to have play slips made out for each individual combination. So until it's fully electronic, you can't really just put that money down. But here's the real kicker is everybody plays when it's this big. And if everybody plays, what if you spend 600 million to win 600 million and lo and behold, somebody else also wins just by the luck of the draw with a quick pick. So it's not worth the risk.
No. So Terry, this was absolutely delightful. I have one, there hasn't been a movie made of this, has there?
Been a couple of documentaries. CNBC has American Greed. They did a half hour special on it and Game Show Network did one. But go ahead and ask your question.
Is there any sort of fraud or true crime that you're binging these days that you would recommend to the audience that you really like?
There are two shows on ABC now that are true crime that come in over the summer. I thought those were as well produced. And every time I see them, I get a little twinge in my stomach, because they really, what you and I've talked about, every one of them have those pieces in there that people get greedy. They need the money. They have the opportunity, and they rationalize why they should be able to win it. So I would say check those out over the summer months. So usually, I think Friday nights at 9 o'clock or somewhere in there.
Okay. Awesome. Well, Terry, thank you so, so much. This has been like delightful. And the timing is so perfect because of the $1.9 billion Powerball. One of my first cases I worked when I was with U.S. Customs was two sisters, little old sisters. They were so cute. They showed up in literally go-go boots. They had been ripped off so much once they won the lottery. It was just, they still had a wonderful attitude. Their banker ripped them off. Family members ripped them off. Investment advisors. I don't know. They bought the ticket when they lived in a manufactured home, you know?
Boy.
And they're like, so we're going to go back to our manufactured home with our new go-go boots. But I couldn't believe their attitude after so many people ripped them off that they really thought they could trust.
It is amazing how many people, most of the stories you hear about lottery winners, a lot of them, they've been there realizing, again, that no one has ever been assaulted or killed from someone they didn't know. Now, a guy, first name Jack, I think down in Florida or down in the Southeast, was killed, but it was by his either girlfriend or ex-wife that wanted more money, you know. So you see people who have lost it, but many of the winners that we had don't get publicized. They have the press conference and then they disappear. You don't see much of them to out there. The formula I like is you give a third to your kids, a third to you, and you put it in your own annuity. Don't take the annuity from the lottery. Do your own annuity, and a third to charity to in the first year to get the taxes knocked down. I think winners that I've seen do that have really come out great, because when you do the annuity, you get so much a year, and with this kind of dollars, you're going to have all the money you can spend, and you're not out having everybody hit you. And then you want to hire somebody that if anybody wants money, charities, that goes through a lawyer, because the stories and the letters that you'll get, my son is dying of cancer, could I just get $1,000?
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen the, it's a HGTV show, My Lottery Dream Home?
Yeah. A fun one.
It's buying pretty home. Funny. I saw it in a hotel because I don't have cable, but I saw it in a hotel a couple of weeks ago, and it was the difference. Like, you know, one family won $1 million, and they lived in a part of the country where, you know, a $300,000 house is just a palace. Versus, you know, you win $1 million in California, it's not going to buy you anywhere close to a palace. But it's kind of fun. It's that sort of.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's well produced.
Yeah.
The folks that do those shows are, you know, they have a formula for sure.
Yeah. Well, Terry, again, thank you so much. And if anyone is out in the audience and you buy a lottery ticket and you win the Powerball, okay, you need to come on Fraudish, okay?
Yeah. I gave away $1 billion in my career in my 10 years of the lottery. I figured out that $1 billion in prizes went out the door. And so I use that kind of as a promo for my speeches, but it is fun.
Well, yeah. And you're an aptonym, Terry Rich.
I'm glad you didn't call me a son of a rich, huh? Old joke.